Okay, well, let's turn in our Bibles to 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel. And tonight we're going to pick up in chapter 4. 2 Samuel chapter 4, as we continue to study the life of King David. I was asked a little earlier about doing prophecy updates. Of course, I reserve the right on Sunday night to do a prophecy update when the time warrants it. Of course, we just did one recently, so I'm going to hold off on a little bit until I see something of significance. Then we will go ahead and do that. Okay, so I want to give you a little summary of King Saul, Jonathan, and David, a timeline summary, historical summary of the relationship of their ages. Sometimes it's hard, when you read through the text, it's very difficult to be able to see their age relationships and understand key dates. I want to focus on some key dates that took place between chapters 13 and 31 in 1 Samuel, which helps give us a perspective. Now, first of all, when we look at their ages, we know that Saul began to reign around 1052 BC, 1052 years before Christ, and he was around 28 years old. And 10 years later, based on 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 1 in the New American Standard Bible, 10 years later, we know that David was born. So 1052 BC, and Saul was 28 at that time. 10 years later, 1042 BC, King Saul's 38. David is born, and we estimate that Jonathan, David's best friend, was age seven at the time that King David was born. We know that Jonathan defeated the Philistines, according to 1 Samuel chapter 14, and he was probably somewhere between ages 20 and 22 when he defeated the Philistines. And of course, David, when he was 15, Jonathan was about age 22. David was anointed king by Samuel, the judge. We learn this in 1 Samuel chapter 16. David was anointed king at about age 15. King Saul is 53 years old at this point in time. We see in between ages 15 and 17, we learn that is when David defeated Goliath. 1 Samuel chapter 17, David was a teenager, and somewhere between the ages of 15 and 17, of course, putting Jonathan between the ages of 22 and 24, and King Saul between 53 and 55. And then we understand in chapter 18 of 1 Samuel that Jonathan and David become very good friends. In fact, best friends. And some say, well, what about the age difference? Got to remember that King David took out Goliath. So he's going to win the respect of somebody 7 years older than he is. You know, he's got to earn that respect. So now, David realizes that by age 21, that Saul wants him dead. Saul disguised that issue pretty much between 17 and 21, when David was between ages 17 and 21. Saul did not realize, this of course was a slow process, that he began to realize that David was being exalted higher than himself, because the ladies would sing, Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his 10,000s. And Saul, his jealousy slowly grew towards David. King Saul appointed David to be commander of the army, along with Abner, his cousin. And David was very successful And so there were a number of years go by where David continues to build a reputation for defeating the Philistines at this time. And by the time he's 21, a significant event takes place where he realizes that Saul wants him dead. So David then flees and he hides his parents in Moab, knowing that his parents' lives are, of course, at stake. And that happened at a significant age, David, 21. And then we skip ahead to the year 1012 BC, when Saul is killed. He's 68 years old, when he's killed by the Philistines at Mount Gilboa. And Jonathan, David's best friend, is also killed at this time. And it's at that point that we learn of Jonathan's son Mephibosheth, which we will read about tonight, who was 5 years old when his father, Mephibosheth's father, Jonathan, died. David's best friend dies. And so it's during this period between ages 21 and 30 that David fled from Saul. For 9 or 10 years, David fled from Saul, hiding. And he had a motley crew following after him. The rejects of Israelite society followed after David, and they brought their families with him. And so for 9 to 10 years, David was hiding, mainly in southern Israel. And then about 16 months, he actually sought asylum with the Philistines. He actually lived in Philistine country for about 16 months during this time, just before King Saul was then killed by the Philistines at Mount Gilboa at the far end of the Jezreel Valley. And so we find that David waited patiently on the Lord during this ages 15 to age 30. He waited patiently on the Lord. He never pushed his way into to seize the throne violently. He refused to do that. He waited patiently on the Lord. Many of his psalms were written, and out of all the psalms that he wrote more about waiting on the Lord than any other psalmist. In fact, out of the 15 psalms that focused on waiting on the Lord, 14 of them were written by David. The importance of waiting on the Lord. Letting the Lord order your steps. Letting the Lord arrange the circumstances such that then you will know that it is your time to move. If we move ahead of the Lord, this is not a good thing. And David's life is an illustration of this. Remember, King Saul made the mistake of moving ahead of the Lord. Remember, he was told to go to Gilgal and wait for Samuel to show up. And rather than waiting, he went ahead and offered sacrifices. And he went ahead of the Lord. He was presumptuous. He was told to totally destroy the Amalekites and their animals and everything, but he didn't do that. He was disobedient, once again being presumptuous, and we're going to be learning about that tonight. Last week we covered chapters 2 and 3 of 2 Samuel, where we see David reigning in Hebron, where he reigns for 7.5 years. And so tonight we pick up with chapter 4. And we understand, and I showed you a map last week, I want to show you again this week, that when David ruled in Hebron, he basically, here's a map of Israel when Saul was during Saul's reign. Actually, that red dotted line with the green area, you'll see the Dead Sea just below that. See if I have a pointer here. Here we go. You'll see the Dead Sea right here, and then there's the Sea of Galilee. Here's Philistia, the Mediterranean Ocean. This area in green is the kingdom of Saul. And when David began to reign, of course, Saul reigned from Dan in the far north to Beersheba in the far south. That was the extent of his reign. And we learn that David, when he was made king by the people in Judah, he had the southern section of Saul's kingdom, in which he was made king over this region, as you see here in blue. And the region to the north of course, Hebron was the capital. And then to the north of Judah was what was called Israel, or the other tribes of Israel, with its capital in Mahanaim. And so this is what the kingdom of Israel looked like when David was king in Judah. The tribes in the north didn't really recognize David as king at the very beginning. A lot of people don't know this, but David once again refused to seize control of the other tribes. He refused to do that because he was not a presumptuous person. He was not. He waited on the Lord. He wanted the Lord to be the one to do it. He didn't want to be presumptuous. He didn't want to assume on the Lord. And that's such an important thing that we need to learn today, because we Americans are immigrants that tend to be aggressive. We tend to seize. That's how we are. It's partly for survival's sake, but also partly because we tend to be rebels. we rebelled against the governments that we were under. At least my relatives did, who fled out of England and ended up in one of the colonies that was where Connecticut's located today. In the 1600s, they came over here on my mom's side, and they rebelled against the king, King George, and they did not, they were self-made people. And so the way I was raised in my family, you were pretty much, you did it. You made things happen. When I was a child, we were raised to be very responsible and to be accountable. And so that's hard to separate. I don't know if anybody here was raised that way, but if you're raised that way, it's really hard to separate. And then when you go to school, they teach you to, they taught me anyway, I don't know about you, but they taught me to be assertive. In college, they reinforce that to, you got to assert yourself. You have a window of opportunity, and that window is only there for a short time, and you got to go through the window, and you got to assert yourself. That wasn't David. That wasn't David. And this is so important for us to realize. God held King David. There's Pastor George. Hi, Pastor George. Everybody say hi to Pastor George. He's doing the card ministry that's out here in the foyer. Are you going to be around, George? Okay. If anybody wants to have any questions about the ministry to the refugees in San Diego, George, Pastor George will be around later. We'll be finished about a little around 7:30. Okay. But David, it was very important to him to not go ahead of the Lord, to wait upon the Lord, and what an example for us to follow, to also wait upon the Lord. Now, we come to chapter 4 of 2 Samuel, and we read in verse 1, when Saul's son, now this would be Ishbosheth. Remember, Saul is dead, Jonathan had died, but Saul had other sons that lived, and here's one of them, Ishbosheth. And when Saul's son heard that Abner had died in Hebron. Now remember, we read last week how David's nephew Joab, he's sort of a half-nephew, but Joab, who was a nephew of David, who was a commander of David's small army of 600 men, remember he conned Abner into meeting him there in Hebron, and then he killed Abner. That was not a good thing. David was very angry at Joab for doing that. Remember now, Abner was the commander under King Saul. He was actually the son of King Saul's brother, the son of King Saul's. So he was King Saul's cousin. Abner was King Saul's King Saul and Abner, their relationship, they were cousins, that was it. So Saul's son heard that Abner had died. Now, Abner, of course, would make Ishbosheth and Abner their relatives too, their cousins. How do you put it? My first cousin once removed? Is that how it goes? I get confused about those things. But nonetheless, Abner, Ishbosheth had heard that his cousin had died in Hebron, and he lost heart. And all Israel was troubled. Now remember, when it says all Israel was troubled, we're speaking of the 10 tribes to the north of Judah. And they were troubled over what was taking place here. And verse 2, now Saul's son, Ishbosheth, had two men who were captains of troops. The name of one was Baanah, and the name of the other was Rechab. Rechab. I can't do that guttural thing very well. The sons of Rimmon the Berothite, and of the children of Benjamin, for Beroth, it's actually Beroth, Beersheba, Beroth, Berothite, of the children of Benjamin, for Beroth also was part of Benjamin, because the Berothites fled to Gittaim and have been sojourners there until this day. Sojourners simply meaning they're not from that region. They're from out of town, and they've been hanging around, so they're sojourners. So this is just a little extraneous information that gives you some color to what's going on here. Verse 4, then Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son. Jonathan, of course, is dead. Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son who was lame in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. Jezreel, of course, is the southernmost end of the Jezreel Valley where Mount Gilboa is located. And his nurse took him up and fled. So news came that Jonathan had died. The son of Jonathan is Mephibosheth. And the nurse that was taking care of this boy, Mephibosheth, she fled as soon as she heard that Jonathan and Saul had died. And in her haste in fleeing, it says that Mephibosheth fell and became lame. And so there you have it. 5 years old, he falls, and he becomes lame in both feet. And I'm not sure how he got around, whether he drug himself around or what they did, but they didn't have wheelchairs back in those days. And so he had to be taken care of. Now, verse 4 is a rabbit trail. It just sort of fits the way I teach. It's a rabbit trail from the main point, because really what we're focused in on here are these two captains were actually reporting to Ishbosheth, the son of Saul. Verse 5, then the sons of Rimmon, the Berothite, Rechab and Baanah, set out and came at about the heat of the day to the house of Ishbosheth, who was lying on his bed at noon. Now, these, keep in mind that these two men are captains that were supposedly under Ishbosheth, the son of Saul. And so they show up to Ishbosheth's home, where he is lying on his bed at noon, verse 6. And they came there all the way into the house as though to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Baanah, his brother, escaped. For when they came into the house, he was lying on his bed in his bedroom. Then they struck him and killed him, beheaded him and took his head, and were all night escaping through the plain. And they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron, and said to the king, here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life, and the Lord has avenged my lord the king this day of Saul and his descendants. And so they were here thinking that they were doing David a favor. Now remember, they were captains under Ishbosheth. They turn on Ishbosheth. They go into his house. They kill him while he's taking a nap in his bed. They cut his head off, and then they take the head of Ishbosheth to David, thinking that, hey, we just did you a big favor. Ishbosheth, who was supposedly the king, as we learned last week, that he was the king, declared king over the tribes of Israel in the north, as you see on our map. He was made king actually by Abner. Now remember, Abner had been killed by Joab, and so Abner, the big powerful general under Saul, he's dead, and that brought fear into Ishbosheth's heart. And then two of his commanders turn on him, kill him, cut his head off, and bring the head to King David, think they're doing King David a favor. Verse 9. But David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, and said to them, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity, when someone told me, saying, 'Look, Saul is dead,' thinking to have brought good news, I arrested him and had him executed at Ziklag, the one who thought I would give him a reward for his news." Here we learn that Amalekite who told David, "Hey, I finished off King Saul. I saw him on his spear, and so I finished him off." He thought he was doing David a favor too, and David, what did he do? He had him put to death. Now he's telling them this story just before, guess what happens to them? Verse 11, "How much more when wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house on his bed? Therefore shall I not now require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth?" So David commanded his young men, and they executed them, cut off their hands and feet, and hanged them by the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner in Hebron. So Ishbosheth was buried with his cousin Abner there in a tomb in Hebron. And these two men, their hands and feet were cut off. I don't know what the significance of that is. I tried to find out the significance of the hands and feet. Perhaps the hands having to do something with their actions and their feet being swift to bring blood, innocent blood. But nonetheless, David had them put to death. So that's chapter 4. And the question is, what can we learn from the action of these two captains? What can we learn? Would it not have been better for Baanah and Rechab if they had not been presumptuous? You see, they made a mistake by presuming that it would be okay to kill Ishbosheth, thinking that they were pleasing David, but they were wrong in their presumption, were they not? They lost their lives over it. Now, to presume is to believe something is true without proof. To presume is to believe something is true without proof. Peter warns against presumption in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 9. Let's turn there, actually verse 11, but let's turn in our Bibles to 2 Peter chapter 2. Just before Revelation, you'll find Peter and Jude and John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John. Just before 1st John. Look at 2nd Peter chapter 2, and we're going to pick up in verse 9. Verse 9, "The Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment, and especially those who walk according to the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise authority." Let's read verse 10 again. "And especially those who walk according to the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise authority, they are presumptuous, self-willed." So how are the unjust presumptuous and self-willed? By not seeking out an authority first before they act. Not seeking authorization before they act. They are presumptuous. The unjust are presumptuous and self-willed by not seeking authority first, seeking authorization first, before they act. That's exactly what Rechab and Baanah did. They acted presumptuously before seeking David's approval and authority. Their presumption led to their downfall. This is exactly what happened to King Saul. He too was presumptuous. Turn with me to 1 Chronicles in chapter 10. 1 Chronicles chapter 10. Of course, the Chronicles were written by the priests. It's sort of a give us a little different perspective. Very 1 and 2 Chronicles are very similar to 1 and 2 Kings, except it gives you a perspective from the priest and the temple. So that's how that you'll find the differences between 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles. 1 and 2 Chronicles emphasize issues surrounding the temple and the priesthood. So we pick up here in 1 Chronicles 10 and verse 13. So Saul died for his unfaithfulness, which he had committed against the Lord. He died for his unfaithfulness because he did not keep the word of the Lord. He didn't keep the word of the Lord. He died for his unfaithfulness, which he had committed against the Lord. Notice, his unfaithfulness, which he had committed, notice, against the Lord. He was unfaithful to the Lord, because he did not keep the word of the Lord, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance. You're not to seek spiritists. You're not to mess around with Ouija boards or with anything having to do with the occult and spiritism. Verse 14, but he did not inquire of the Lord, therefore he killed him. He did not inquire of the Lord, therefore God killed him. And he turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse. The biggest difference between King Saul and David is that David was not presumptuous in that he sought the Lord. He did not presume upon the Lord. He didn't presume, well, this is okay. He didn't do that. He inquired of the Lord. Isn't that what we've been finding as we've been studying the life of David? He was continually inquiring of the Lord. He would inquire the Lord before he would act. We see many examples of this in David's life, but King Saul didn't do that. He didn't inquire of the Lord, and as a result, the Lord killed him. When you inquire of the Lord, it's because of faith. When you believe God and you truly put your confidence in Him, you will inquire of Him, will you not? You'll go to Him, you'll talk to Him, you'll ask Him, and you'll seek Him. We learn in Proverbs 3, 5 through 7, which was written by King David's son Solomon. He writes, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct your paths. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil. And so David practiced this, and he passed this on to his son Solomon. How important it is to trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. What does that mean to not lean on your own understanding? What does that mean? And this is the hardest part, because we tend to fill our head with a bunch of information if we're trying to make a decision. So we go on the internet, or whatever, I don't know where you go, but go on the internet and we research it. We try to separate the fake news from the real stuff and get the correct information. And then we fill our heads with all our facts, and then we perhaps maybe you have a column where you have pros and cons, and then you measure them, and then you make a decision. Well, that's okay, but if the Lord's left out of the equation, then what have you done? You didn't include Him. You know, perhaps you're good at plumbing, and so your plumbing breaks, and so you think, well, I can fix that. It's no big deal. I'll just run down to the Home Depot, and I'll pick up a valve and a stem and a gasket, and I'll come back in, and I'll fix the leak, and no problem. And you don't bother to inquire the Lord and talk to Him about it. That's what He's talking about. Proverbs 3:6. In all your ways, not just in the ways that you're not sure of because you're not sure. See, this is the hardest part, isn't it? Because this is where we all struggle. When you get in the car, oh, I've driven this car. I can drive this car blindfolded. No, don't do that. I know it so well, but we acknowledge the Lord. So it's something, it's presumption. It's not, Lord, you know, I'm about to move out. Lord, I need your help. Lord, please help me this day. Waking up in the morning, Lord, I give you this day. I don't know what's ahead of me, so I lay this day before you. I don't know what to expect. I acknowledge you in this day. And that's a battle, is it not? Has it ever happened to you when you, oh, I'm running a little late for work. I'll have to catch up with you tomorrow, Lord. Wow. Applying this advice from Proverbs 3:5-7 in my life will protect me from presumptuous and willful acts that I otherwise would probably commit. How many times did I get into trouble because I didn't acknowledge the Lord? Paul exhorts all believers to pray for boldness before we act on anything, to ask the Lord for help. You know, of course, our biggest calling isn't just about how to fix your plumbing, but we are called to be witnesses. And so, am I praying that prayer that Paul asked the Ephesians to pray for him? We read in Ephesians 6:18-19. Let's turn there. Ephesians 6:8-19. God eats peaches and cream. Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, and Colossians. Go eat popcorn is another one. That's how I when I first memorized this. Galatians 6:18, we read, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints, and for me, that utterance may be given to me. So you're to pray. Paul's asking the Ephesians to pray for him that utterance may be given to him, that I may open my mouth boldly to make known the mystery of the gospel. So Paul is saying, look, I don't want to go out there unprotected from prayer. I'm asking you to pray for me and to inquire of the Lord and to seek Him to help me so that I will be able to speak to those what God wants me to say. So what if I don't do that and I decide, oh, I'm going to go share the gospel with my boss today. And then you get up, you walk into the office and you start sharing the gospel without inquiring of the Lord. Well, I'm bold, I've got boldness. Let me demonstrate my boldness. Well, boldness isn't any good without prayer, right? If I don't first pray, what good is that boldness? Wasn't King Saul bold when he decided to, well, Samuel's late, so I'll just go ahead and offer the sacrifice of myself. Wasn't that bold? But God, that didn't please God. And then Saul decided to save the best Amalekite, you know, the king, the Amalekite king, and the best animals and so on. And then when he was challenged on it by Samuel, what did Saul do? He blamed it on the people. It wasn't my fault, it was their fault. They're the ones that kept the best of the animals, and they're the ones that wanted to bring... But he's king. How did Truman put it, President Truman? The buck stops here, isn't that what he... The buck stops with Saul. And so we're to inquire of the Lord. That is the thing that he's teaching us in this world. teaching us to rely on Him. Why do you suppose that is? Why do you suppose that God's primary goal for you in this life is to learn faith and to learn hope and to learn to love? Because those are the three things that remain, right? 1 Corinthians 13:13 says, "And these three abide." And the Greek behind the word abide there is forever. It's the idea it's going to go on. What three abide? What three are going to go on into eternity? Faith, hope, love. And so we're learning faith now, and that faith is going to continue on into eternity. And so He wants us to learn to go to Him now, to inquire in Him, and to make that a part of our who we are, and make that a part of our daily life, to seek Him, to acknowledge Him. In all my ways, acknowledge Him. And as I do, then what will happen? Then I'll find success as I acknowledge Him. But success from whose point of view? And so we tend to measure success based on how much money we make and how we can, you know, that kind of thing. And that's not correct. It's not based on faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these three is what? Love. Why is that? Why does He say the greatest of these three is love? Well, you see, the foundation to coming to the point of loving others is faith and hope. You learn faith and hope so that you can love. And that's why love is the greatest. Because if you're loving, then you're in faith and hope. Faith and hope is a prerequisite to love. And so when I can get to the point to where I can turn the other cheek and love my enemies, even though they slander me and they come against me and they accuse me, then I have learned faith and hope. And then I will take that with me into eternity. And that's the bottom line of all of this. And David had that, even though he was a violent guy and he was sort of cocky. That's one thing that he knew how to do. He knew that this thing that he was put into, he was made king, right? And what did he do right after he was anointed king? He said, okay, where's the throne? Where do I go? Where's my robe? Is that what he did? No, he went out back out to the sheep. That's what it says. He went back out to the sheep. Why? Because that's what I know. And this thing about me being king, this little flea there in Bethlehem, and I'm the youngest of all these other grown-up boys, three of which are in the military. Who am I? I'll go back and watch the sheep. Isn't that humility? I don't know what is. Well, I have every right to seize power, you know. He didn't do that. In fact, when he went to play the harp for the king, what would he do? When he was done, he'd go back home and he'd watch the sheep. And his brother even ridiculed him, you know, a couple of years later by saying, oh, you know, what are you doing here making riffraff? That's another way. Causing this riffraff, you know, referring to him as sort of an arrogant kind of guy, you know, who you just watch over a few sheep. You know, sort of ridiculing his own brother in front of the men. That David just ignored his brother and asked, he persisted in his question and wanted to know the answer. We must seek the Lord. If we share the gospel, we must seek the Lord first to ask Him. You know, in fact, let's turn to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter 3. We were just in Peter, weren't we? Let's go there again. 1 Peter 3:15. But sanctify the Lord in your hearts. Set apart as holy the Lord in your hearts. That's the first thing you're to do before you do the next step. You set apart the Lord as holy in your heart. And then the next step is to always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you, and with meekness and fear. Notice what you do. Notice the order. You set apart the Lord as holy in your hearts first. You acknowledge Him. And then you are to be prepared to give everyone an answer. For the hope, notice the word hope. For a reason for the hope that is in you, but with meekness and fear. These three remain: faith, hope, and love. I'm learning faith, and I'm learning hope, and I want to share that hope with those who don't have hope. What is hope in the New Testament? Romans 8:25 tells us that hope is an eager waiting, eagerly waiting, eager expectation. There is no doubt in the Greek word for hope in the New Testament. There's no room for doubt. In our English language, the word hope implies a certain degree of doubt. The degree of doubt depends on the severity of the situation, does it not? So you might say, what's the news about your job situation? What's going on? Well, I don't have a full grasp of what's going on, but I sure hope they don't fire me. Versus, they've said some pretty bad things about me. My boss came in and he rebuked me for this thing, and now they're laying people off, and gee, I sure hope I'm not fired. Can you see the measure of degree between those two hopes? I don't really know much. They didn't put me down. They didn't attack me. I have a good record here versus it doesn't look too good. So it's a matter of degree. I, you know, the first hope, it's about, well, it's 90%. I have a hope of 90%. And the second example was, gee, it's more like a 40% hope. In the New Testament, it's 100%. When they use the word hope in the New Testament, it's 100%. It's having a confident expectation, eagerly waiting for what you know is going to come to pass. Faith is now, hope adds the element of time. Because hope is faith coming. That's a good way to put it. Hope is a confident expectation that it's coming, and I'm eagerly waiting for it. That's how it's... Let's turn there. Romans 5. Go to Romans 5. I mean Romans 8. Romans 8. And look at this. Romans 8. This is really cool. I love this section. He's talking here about the suffering of creation and waiting in hope for the Son of the children of God to be liberated. And then we get to verse 24. Look at verse 23. Not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, just like creation groans, eagerly waiting. There it is. Eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of our body. Now, you're eagerly waiting for the redemption of your body. How many here are not eagerly waiting? I mean, as you get older, you're even more eager, right? Because the body just doesn't function like it used to. Then look at verse 24. For we were saved in this hope. hope. But hope that is seen is not hope, for why does one still hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, and here it is, we eagerly wait for it with perseverance. You eagerly wait for it. It hasn't gotten here yet, but my confidence that it's coming is 100%, that I'm going to be redeemed. You see that? And that's New Testament hope. So faith, hope, and love, these three remain. And this is what David exudes in who he is. He has faith in the Lord. He does not presume upon the Lord. There's only a few times that he does. And we'll come to that. We're going to be getting to that. And he has hope in God. And you read his Psalms and you cannot miss it. Now, he will get a little emotional and he will just let his thoughts be known, and he'll just say what he thinks, and he won't sound like a very good guy. You know, I hate those who hate you, and I hate them with the utmost hatred, and I want to crush them. That's how he writes his Psalms. But are we to take that as doctrine? Is that what we're to do? No, he's just expressing how he feels about it. Very transparent about how he feels about it. But as you read his Psalms, you will discover that when he goes through these moments of despair and darkness and or anger or whatever it may be, he always ends up by acknowledging that the Lord is on the throne and the Lord is in control and he's sovereign, and I will praise the Lord. And that's how he ends his Psalms. You'll see this over and over again in the Psalms that he writes, even in the imprecatory Psalms where he's in such despair. That's what he does. And what is the basis for this? Faith, hope, and in the process, God's teaching, love. Because the greatest of these three is love. And that's the direction in which all of us are headed, and how we learn the lesson behind faith, inquiring of him, never presuming upon him, and trusting him, and then hoping, knowing with confidence that what he has promised has come. And that's where David is. That's his whole heart. In Saul, we saw hesitancy and confusion and so we are to sanctify the Lord in our heart first and acknowledge him in our hearts first, and then be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks about the hope that lies within, the hope, that confident expectation that you know is on its way, that you're eagerly waiting for, but with meekness and fear. So, these two passages here in the New Testament in Ephesians 6 and 1 Peter 3 are showing us that how important it is to put the Lord first. He's got to be there first. And regardless of how feeble your knowledge is of the Scriptures, and I remember when I was a relatively new Christian, I'd go to Melody Land and I'd go to the prayer meeting over there, and I couldn't pray anything like those guys did. They were mostly pastors. I'd go before I'd go to work at Disneyland because they'd meet at 6:30. And a friend of mine, we'd go there and we'd pray with them. And they pray these, oh my gosh, you could see. And these older men. And I thought, wow, I don't know how to pray. You know, Lord, teach me. It doesn't matter how eloquent your words are. He just wants to know where your heart is. He wants you to simply inquire of him and ask him before you act. Otherwise, it's presumption, is it not? Like Ba'ana and Rechab. They were presumptuous. All they had to do was go to David and say, hey, what do you want us to do with Ishbosheth? We have access to him. We can walk right up to him and cut his head off and bring his head to him. What do you want us to do? We'll do whatever you want. And there, that would have been the correct way. And as a result, what happened to him? their hands and feet were cut off. They were put to death. No, the other way around. They were put to death and their hands and feet were cut off. Right? Presumption got both of them into trouble with David. Indeed, King Saul was also in trouble with God because of this. Let's go to 2 Samuel 5. Back to 2 Samuel 5. We'll finish up here. I have some stuff I want you to see that I think is pretty cool. I did some research at some reputable websites. Don't you have to say that nowadays? You can't just say I went to the internet anymore, because fake news is everywhere. You go on and you wonder, you get what you think is a good article about what's going on, and it's fake. They just make it up. And you go, well, my gosh, you got to check out your source, right? Sort of like you used to do in the old days when you had to get a good footnote to back up what you were saying. You know, that's funny. I always used to think the footnotes had the final authority when I was in college. Footnotes, oh, it's footnoted. That's the final authority. Really? Is that the footnote's the final authority? No, they're just quoting somebody else that might be fallible, right? So, you see, the only true authority that we have is the Word of God. That's the final authority. Okay, anyway, I want to show you something. Let's go to 2 Samuel 5. Chapter 5, 2 Samuel 5, verse 1. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and spoke, saying, now notice there at Hebron, south of Jerusalem, Hebron, all the tribes of Israel, remember that's, let me go back one slide here. The tribes up there in the north, where's my little deal? Here it is. Okay, so the tribes up here in the north, ooh, my battery's running low. Can you see my little red thing? All these tribes up here in the red, the tribes of Israel, they come down to Hebron and they approach David. Indeed, we are your bone and your flesh, they say. So they're coming in humility. We're recognizing that we're flesh and blood. We're related. Verse 2, also in time past when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel and brought them in. And you were the one that led Israel out and brought them in, and the Lord said to you, you shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over them. So they're remembering Saul's anointing of David as the king. And verse 3, therefore all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. So now, notice what took place here. They come to David and they say, David, we want you to be king. He didn't go in there and take control and slaughter their leaders and say and subjugate them to him. He didn't do that. You see that? That's very important. They came to David and they say, we recognize that you are one of us, and we remember what was said in the past, and we want you to be king over us. And this was the final step in David becoming king over all of Israel. He didn't force it on them. He let them come to him. And this just shows you the kind of person that David is. And so they entered into this covenant, verse 3, with them at Hebron and before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. And so now it's all one. And David was 30 years old when he began to reign, verse 4, and he reigned 40 years. Now, David died in the last year of his reign, and Solomon took over. This tells us, this verse right here tells us, that David died when he was 70 years old. Now, he had a rough life. If you have a rough life, Zamperini's probably an exception to the rule. He had a rough life, and he made it to about, what, age 93 or 94. But usually if your body is beaten up and you've had a lot of rough time, the body is just not going to last as long. Verse 5. In Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem. He reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. And the king and his men, verse 6, went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, and spoke to David, saying, "You shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame will repel you," thinking that David cannot come in here. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is, the city of David. And David said on that day, "Whoever climbs up by way of the water shaft," here we learn of this water shaft, "and defeats the Jebusites, the lame and the blind who are hated by David's soul, he shall be chief and captain. Therefore they say, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house." And we have this little confusing verse. It's a little confusing. So I wanted to read verse 8 to you from the New Living Translation, which reads as follows. Verse 8 of 2 Samuel 5 reads as follows. "On the day of the attack, David said to his troops, 'I hate those lame and blind Jebusites.'" It's sort of a derogatory metaphor against the Jebusites. "Whoever attacks them should strike by going into the city through the water tunnel." And that is the origin of the saying, "The blind and the lame may not enter the house." So that helps clarify a little bit about what's going on. Now notice David is just sharing. He's very transparent. I think of our current president. He's very transparent. He just says whatever's on his mind. David is a lot like that. David just shares. He's sharing what is on his mind. He shares his feelings. He's a very emotional guy. And he's sharing his thoughts. Now, David puts out this challenge. He says, "Whoever defeats the Jebusites by climbing up through the water shaft shall be chief and captain." Now, we learn that this actually took place in 1 Chronicles 11, 6-9. And allow me to read that to you so you don't have to turn there. Now, David said, this is out of 1 Chronicles 11, verse 6. "Now David said, 'Whoever attacks the Jebusites first shall be chief and captain.' And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first and became chief." Now Zeruiah was a relative to David. Zeruiah, there's a woman by the way, she gave birth to Joab, who was like Zeruiah was a half-sister, it is believed, of David. So that would make Joab a half-nephew. So this is the relationship between Joab and David. And Joab became chief. He went up the shaft. Now remember, Joab was already one of the leaders under David with the 600 rejects that followed David. Joab was one of those that followed David. He's a nephew, so he's younger than David, not by much, but he nonetheless is a leader. Then it goes on to say in 1 Chronicles 11, 6, in verse 7, "Then David dwelt in the stronghold," that is, therefore they called it the city of David, "and he built the city around it from the Millo to the surrounding area. Joab repaired the rest of the city, so David went on, became great, and the Lord of hosts was with him." That's according to 1 Chronicles 11, 6-9. Now let's go back to verse 9. In 2 Samuel 5, "Then David dwelt in the stronghold and called it the city of David, and David built around it from the Millo and inward." Now, I want to show you here what it may have looked like. Now, this is 2 Samuel chapter 5, and this is the Jebusite city water shaft. This is sort of a drawing of what it might look like. Now, I think I've lost my let's see. Yeah, I'll have to walk up here because it's not even showing anymore. Down here is a Kidron Valley. You can see way over here to the right. And then there's a spring, the Gihon Spring, right down here. Now, ignore this tunnel here, because this was built by Hezekiah some 300 years after King David. This right here. Some of you have, has anybody walked through this? Hezekiah's tunnel? Okay, this tunnel was built during the time of Hezekiah, 300 years after David. So this tunnel did not exist at the time of King David, nor did this shaft that they call Warren's Shaft. They put out the wrong information. When I was there, they were saying they believed Warren's Shaft was the shaft that Joab went up. He went. Notice how vertical it is and how tall it is. It's a long ways up. I think that's about 40 feet. He went up that shaft, and then he went through the access tunnel, And then, I can't reach it, but right up here. And then he actually accessed the city of the Jebusites, which was behind this. Here's the Jebusite wall here, and the city was up here, and here's the valley below. So that's what they think. But in reality, there's another access point that's now blocked. They believe that Joab went through here because this didn't exist. None of this exists in the time of David. The spring did, but this didn't exist, and this shaft didn't exist. So Joab probably came in through this tunnel, and then he went up this shaft, and then he entered into the Jebusite city. So that's the theory. I thought that was rather cool. Isn't that cool? So next time we go to Israel, I'll show you where that is, because I know where it is. Okay, it's fun. Now here's a picture of a shaft in that area. It's straight down, by the way. That's straight down. Here's somebody, they put a ladder so you can see he's climbing up the ladder. Here's another picture of the shaft that Joab made. Now, Joab didn't have stairs. Okay, there were no stairs. Anyway. Okay, now, David, when he was made king, this is after 7.5 years in ruling in Hebron. Here's our map. There's Hebron on the bottom. See it just above Judah. David moved the capital to Jerusalem. This is what we just read. Now, Gibeah was capital when Saul was there. And then David made Hebron the capital for 7.5 years. Waiting, once again, waiting. Now remember, he waited 15 years to be king. Now he waits another 7.5 years for the Israel in the north, the tribes in the north, to finally come to him and say, hey, will you be our king? So it's been 22.5 years that he's actually realizing the full effect. And then when he's made king, what does he do? He decides to move the capital up to what is now known as Jebus at this time. They were the Jebusites, which King Saul never controlled that area. You'll see why in a moment. David then goes to Jebus, and then he makes Jebus Jerusalem, and that becomes the capital of Israel. And that was in 1004 BC. In 1996, when we went there, in 1996, we celebrated 3,000 years of the founding of the capital of Jerusalem. Do you remember that, Marge? Yeah, we got little buttons that said the 3,000 years celebration of Jerusalem. 1996. Now, I want to show you something else. Okay, this you'll see in your Bibles, this map here. See that map? Does that look familiar? That's Jerusalem that you see. Okay, now I want to show you the city that David founded. I want to show you how small it is relative to what you see up there. So this is Jerusalem at the time of Jesus with the walls and so on. You can see the Temple Mount up there. I wish I had a good pointer that worked. That's the Temple Mount. That's the city of David right there in red. That was the city of David. It's on one of three hills. It was the smallest hill. And that's where the Jebusites existed. David did not have the Temple Mount. That didn't come until later under Solomon. So now, see here, this is a picture of Jerusalem, of the old city. And you can see the Golden Dome. See the Golden Dome? Okay, and that white area? That is the Temple Mount right over here. And I want to show you now where the city of David, I can't reach. I wish I had a pointer. Don't you know your little pointer thing? When a battery goes out, it's out. Maybe I can do it this way. You look to your left, and the city of David is right to the left. And it's a basically an Arab village now, where the city of David is. Israel has access to some of that land, and they're excavating it, as you're going to see in a moment. Here's another vision. Maybe you can see it here in the foreground. Now, there's old Jerusalem, time of Jesus. Okay, sort of. Okay, there's the Kidron Valley there. Here's the Hinnom Valley. There's the Temple Mount. There's the city of David. I'll show you again. See, it's a bunch of villages, a bunch of homes there right now. The very bottom of this, the city of David, is the Pool of Siloam. That's where the Hezekiah tunnel exits, down on the bottom here. Okay? This is a model of Jerusalem, the time of Jesus. There's the Temple Mount. There's the city of David. Everything around that did not exist. It was just basically open hills and so on. The blue area was added after King David. Here's another picture. And that area in red is the city of David. There's the city of David with the Temple Mount in the background. West Jerusalem is in the background. East Jerusalem. Here's another picture. Now, this is probably what it looked like in the time of David and Solomon. Okay, there's David. Oops, there's David's city. City of David right there in blue. See that? See the valley to the right? That's the Kidron Valley. The valley to the left is the Tyropian Valley. And then the area in yellow, Solomon built the temple up there, which today is the Temple Mount. So David knew the blue area. Okay. That was free of charge. Now let's look at, what time is it? Oh, 7:30. Let's just finish these verses, okay? It'll be fast. So David went on and became great, and the Lord of hosts was with him. Okay, isn't that cool? The idea behind was with him means that God gave him success as Israel's king. And why is it that God gave him success? Because David was not presumptuous. He would inquire of the Lord. That's what he would do. Now we will read about one of those successes. Verse 11, then Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees and carpenters and masons, and they built David a house. Hiram was the king of Tyre, which was to the north, which is today Lebanon, which Israel never, by the way, conquered Lebanon. Lebanon was where Tyre, the king of Tyre, was, and he actually helped David build his palace. Yes, he helped David build his palace. I want to show you where the palace is. Now, do you recognize that? That's the city of David. I'm gonna move in on here. I'm gonna bring it up a little closer. Now I want you to notice what is called the Jebusite stepped structure. Okay, see that? That's a stepped structure. We that's been excavated, so you can see that today. We're a little closer now. See that stepped structure? Right above that stepped structure is where they believe David's palace was located. There's the stepped structure today. See it there? There. This obviously is a model here. This is a model of what the city of David would have looked like when David was king. And there's the step structure, and you'll see it right there. I'm going to get a little closer to that step structure because you can see the houses above. Okay, those are homes. Israel's taking control of the area just above the step structure because they believe that's where the palace was, just above that. I won't read that, but this is describing the step structure. And the steps, there it is, a close-up of it. Stepstone Jebusite structure in the city of David. You can see that today. We actually saw it when we were there in Israel. There's a little area where you can actually walk on top of it and walk below it and take a close look up. There's a pretty clean shot of the stepstone excavation, the city of David. Isn't that cool? It's real, guys. That's the point. It's real. There it is. It's so exciting. And they say, that never existed. And that's, for heaven's sakes, that's, what is this, 2000 BC? That's 3,000 years old right there. Now, of course, the step structure was covered with plaster, so it didn't look like the stones there. It was, the plaster's all worn away, right? And they excavate it and all. But there it is, the step structure. And it's there, right there, and there it is right there. And then right above it, you'll see the Palace of David, which obviously doesn't exist today, right? It's gone. The houses are in its place. So there's the step structure again. There it is closer. There it is today, archaeological site. That's controlled by the Antiquities of Israel today. Okay. Cool, isn't it? Now watch this. Watch this. So David knew, verse 12, let's look at verse 12. David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. So, oh, the verse above it, verse 11. And they built David a house. And they built David a house. I want to show you in this map right here. There's the city of David, okay? There's the old city today, the four quarters, the Jewish quarter, the Muslim quarter, the Christian quarter, and the Armenian quarter. Okay, so then the Kidron Valley, there's the Temple Mount, there's the city of David. Where would David's palace be located here in this picture? I'll show you, right there. That's where the palace would have been located today. And you can drive on a road right by it and not even know that you're driving right by what would have been David's palace. So, there you have it. Cool. I'll leave that there. Let's finish this up. So David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel. Now notice, very important. Highlight it, underline it. David knew that the Lord had established him. The Lord did it. He didn't push his way into power. That's so cool. I love it. And that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of the people Israel. And that he, God, had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. David never promoted himself to be Israel's king. He let the Lord do it. Even after Ish-bosheth declared himself king, and he reigned for king over the 10 tribes in the north, 11 tribes in the north, for 2 years, David didn't challenge him. In fact, the one who killed Ish-bosheth, the two that killed him, he put them to death. So, verse 13, and David took more concubines and wives, here we go, from Jerusalem, after he had come from Hebron. Also more sons and daughters were born to David. So up to this point, David had 6 wives. He now takes more wives and concubines. Verse 14, now these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem. And it goes on and gives all the names. Notice Nathan is a significant one there. Nathan and Solomon are significant. I won't go through all the names. But verse 17, now when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David, and David heard of it and went down to the stronghold. The Philistines also went and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up? Now notice, see what he did? He inquired of the Lord. He wasn't pretentious, wasn't presumptuous. He went, Lord, what do you want me to do? Lord, here they are, so you tell me. So he inquired of the Lord, and shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you deliver them into my hand? And the Lord said to David, go up, for I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into your hands. So so David went to Baal Perazim, and David defeated them there. And he said, the Lord has broken through the enemies before me like a breakthrough of water. Therefore he called the name of the place Baal Perazim. Now, here's how the NLT reads on this verse. The NLT for verse 20 reads, so David went to Baal Perazim and defeated the Philistines there. The Lord did it, David exclaimed. The Lord did it. He burst through the enemies like a raging flood, so he named that place Baal Perazim, which means the Lord who bursts through. He gave all the glory to the Lord. And they left their images and David and his men carried them away because of the victors, and the Philistines went up once again and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim. Therefore David inquired of the Lord. There it is again. He inquired of the Lord, showing his unpretentious way, and he said, you shall not go up, circle around behind them, and come up upon them in the front of the mulberry trees. And it shall be when you hear the sound of the marching of the tops of the mulberry trees, then you shall advance quickly, for then the Lord will go out before you to strike the camp of the Philistines. And David did so. So the Lord commanded him, and he drove back the Philistines from Geba as far as Gezer. And there you have it. Let's stand. He inquired of the Lord. Isn't that cool? He inquired of the Lord. Let's stand. It's okay to stand, everyone. You usually wait for me to say a prayer or something. Joshua 1:8 says this, this book of the law, as God is addressing Joshua, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, that you may observe and do according to all that is written in it. for then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. So, meditate on the word, you do what it says, and what's the bottom line of what the word says? To seek the Lord, and operate in faith, hope, and love. These three abide, and the greatest of these is love. And isn't that cool? So that's, we see David, we see this in David. Thank you, Lord, for your word that you've given us as a lamp unto our feet, a light to our path. Thank you for the life of David to illustrate to us who you are and what it is you expect of us. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. We'll pick up with chapter 6 next week. So we'll see you then. I got some more PowerPoint for you next week, so make sure you come on back. See you then. God bless.